Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Wake up to something different on Sunday mornings by joining me, Pete Evans, for Spinning Jazz. The finest in modern jazz, from hard bop to bossa nova, from Latin to soul. That's Spinning Jazz every Sunday morning at 9 on Sheffield Live. 93.2 FM.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk, and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live. Hello, it's Saturday afternoon. You're listening to The Film Show on Sheffield Live. I'm Denise.
I'm Martin. Welcome to the film show. We're hoping it's going to be a much calmer, straightforward show than the mayhem of last week.
Yeah, calmer inside. It's not calm outside. It's blizzardy out there.
That wind's blowing out there.
Lots of rain fuss on the way in this morning.
So, touch wood, we think we've got CD playing all right, so technically we should be okay for that. We've got a load of varied stuff to get through. So as long as we don't have any hitches, this show just... might be, well, let's say, slightly less chaotic than last week.
We've got lots and lots, though, haven't we, today?
Oh, yes, yeah. So to kick off with in news, the Penistone Paramount Cinema, which has been open now as a cinema for 110 years, since 1915. Have you ever been there?
No, but I am going to make my way there at the end of the month for their Silent Film Festival.
Oh, of course, yes. Yeah. Yes, well, we shall be talking about that. Yeah. It is going to have a second screen installed. Apparently, planning permission has been granted, and there's going to be a small bijou auditorium. I think maybe only 30 or 40 screens.
Seats, sorry,
yeah. Screens. So you've got it wrong already.
Peniston's getting that big, eh?
Where's the whiskey? Seats. That will expand, I suppose, the range of stuff they can put on. But, if you've never been there, they have this amazing organ, and they have organ recitals in there as well. And they're very famous. I don't know if they should still be doing this, but they stopped the film halfway so you can go to the bar.
Martin Scorsese would not like that.
No. Well, I think Scorsese would be the first up at the bar, actually. We will look forward to finding out more news about that. But what
would be exciting for them, because they can show more films at once.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
They can show a little bit of an independent thing.
Have a record range, because obviously a cinema like that would have to show a lot of the big movies, and probably do all the National Theatre stuff and all that as well. But there's always that room then for going a little bit different. Off-piste.
Yeah. Good for them.
Staying with independent cinemas in the South Yorkshire area, the Parkway Cinema Barnsley.
Still not been there either, but you're going to take me for this, aren't you?
Am I?
Yeah.
Well, you'll have to be nice to me, won't you? And could you get me a coffee, please?
Get out.
We've said before, and praised to the high heavens, the fact that the Parkway Cinema is one of the very few cinemas in this country that can show film on 70mm. Now, last week we reviewed One Battle After Another, which was shot in VistaVision. You've been reading about this? You have, haven't you?
Yeah.
I didn't know if you wanted to jump in. I don't want to just be me rattling on about this.
I like it when it's just you.
I don't.
You were very excited that they're showing this in November. Dates to be confirmed. We both came out of the screening of One Battle After Another going, look, it wasn't perfect, but I would like to see it again on a big screen.
So the Parkway is going to be showing One Battle After Another in 70mm. So that means it will be on film. One of their auditorium is capable, as I say, of showing 70mm. And if you're wanting to see it on a big screen, I know it was in IMAX this week, I think, at Cineworld, but I think if you're going to see it and you want to make the effort, go to Barnsley, see it in 70mm, because, as I said before, the Parkway Cinema itself is an amazing cinema right in the centre of town, and that'll be the way to do it, I think. Now, there's going to be a few screenings. It looks like it's the second week of November. The timings there aren't confirmed yet, but have a look, and you've got about 4 weeks, I think, until the film is screened, and that's one definitely for your diaries. And staying at the Parkway Cinema, I noticed they have a I thought this was a lovely initiative that they're doing there. It's called Know Your Neighbourhood Screenings. And they're free screenings. And next Tuesday at 1 o'clock, there is the second of these screenings. And it's like a community-based screening initiative, primarily for people who may be on their own, maybe not getting out much, to create an environment where people can just come along, see a film, doesn't cost them anything. You can't book, you just have to turn up on the day and go in and see the film. Ostensibly, it's for over 50s, so you'll be all right, Denise.
Can go. And thanks, the biggest secret of the film show is out.
Oh, that's no secret, baby. That's no secret. So the second of these screenings, and you'll be pleased to know that next week's screening is my guiltiest pleasure of 2024.
Oh, yeah?
Mrs. Harris goes to Paris.
Oh.
I am thinking of going.
Oh.
I've not seen it on the big screen.
Did you see it at the Crucible when it was originally on
No. But, I mean, you know, everything about it I should hate, but I love it. And then halfway through, Isabel Huppert turns up in it. And, you know, and you sit there and think, this just might be the greatest film ever made. Now, again, if you want to have a schlep over to Barnsley, what wouldn't you like about seeing this film for nothing in a beautiful cinema?
As a bonus, you may get to see Martin Carter crying in a corner.
I'll tell you, I would be in floods of tears. So you can just come up and laugh at me. We'll keep you abreast of any more of these screenings that might be happening. What's this next bit we've got? Tilly Norwood, star of the future, it would seem. I haven't gone too deeply into this.
AI. We're going AI.
The first AI film star, allegedly.
Created a bit of a reaction, hasn't it?
Yes.
I don't know what to say about this, really. It's
go away, what I would like to say.
It's caused a bit of a fuss, hasn't it?
There's a short promotional film, isn't there, with this... with a female actor called Tilly Norwood, who has been generated by artificial intelligence.
And she just looks like one of those Surrey girls, doesn't she?
she looks like she's like a TV presenter on, I don't know, some Freeview channel that's way up in the 200s or something,
she looks very pretty and appealing, brunette, not very threatening.
No.
Smiley.
Yeah. I'm falling
wavy.
Asleep now. But we've sort of had this before. I was looking back, so I remember about 25 years ago, there was a science fiction film called Final Fantasy that was based on a computer game. And for the time, they had used the most up-to-date computer generation. And this is going to change cinema. We won't need film stars anymore. I mean...
I do love how whenever we find one of these stories, there's always a film that Martin saw in the 80s. We can go, do you remember this film called this? No one remembers that film, Martin, except you. But bring it on.
And that is why this show is so rich. We don't just sit there going, I remember last week. anyway, that was going to change cinema. It didn't. And to be quite honest, you look at it now. Well, you look at it then, and it didn't look much better than an episode of Captain Pugwash. And, yeah. Now, I know AI is very different, and we are in a different world with computer technologies and what CGI has been able to do. We were only talking about Avatar, weren't we, the other week? But, as I say, the thought of watching Avatar just fills me with dread. And, we've also got this sort of technology to celebrate the fact that Jar Jar Binks is in our lives as well. So whether or not this is going to actually change anything, I just hope not. But I did like what the great Ralph Ineson's reaction to it was. F off.
I think some actors have got together with some kind of petition as well, and you just say,
yeah, oh, yeah. Maybe they should bring back Luddites and start burning down computer centres. That's what you need to do.
Petition ain't going to cut it, guys.
No, it's gone way beyond that. I don't know if this is the right bell or not, but I'm handing this over to you.
Okay, go on. We have to mention the very sad passing of Dame Catherine Patricia Routledge.
God bless her.
So she's died this week at the age of 96. She was, she never really stopped working since about 1952, mostly on stage, including Broadway, the RSC, West End. But she really got... she was in films as well, but mostly as like a supporting character or a character actress. But then in like about 1982, I think it was, she's cast in Alan Bennett's Talking Heads one-off as a woman of no importance, who is this kind of figure who thinks that she's more important than she is, and she leaves her admin job and she's unwell and in hospital and sort of bossing all the people about as if she's still at work and the boss. And gradually you find out that she's not as important as she thinks or cared about as she thinks. And then she was cast in what was going to be a short-lived sitcom by Roy Clark on the BBC, Keeping Up Appearances, and she became a household name, not just someone you recognise a bit from something, but massively famous in her middle age. I remember her as Kitty in Victoria Wood, this magically poisonous upper middle class kind of cow, really, who would sit and hold court and make judgments about people in a very Victoria Wood incisive, funny way. A lovely lady, it seems. And also had a big TV series with the BBC with Hetty Wainthrop as well, which was Sunday night viewing, I think, family viewing. So not a lot. I mean, I Keeping Up Appearances is something I couldn't watch because it's too cringy for me.
Yeah.
But she was undoubtedly amazing in it, and she just inhabited this character. But it's one of those difficult sitcoms to watch where the lead is so unbearable, and it's one of those British characters that we do
and it's one of those characters that never learns anything.
Absolutely.
They come a cropper in every episode,
like a Basil Fawlty, or
but there's only 12 episodes of that. There's hundreds, it seems, of Keeping Up Appearances. So a sad farewell then,
but very significant
Patricia
figure,
Routledge. And we shall move swiftly into Trailer Trash.
Oh, Trailer Trash this week. Right. Can I start with Wuthering Heights?
Well, of course you can.
Oh, right. Wuthering Heights is one of those classics of literature that some people have got an amazing relationship with, and especially young girls when they read it and they get this sort of sexual awakening, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
This talk of lust and... I never read Wuthering Heights when I was young enough, and I've only ever seen it as an older person and just gone, well, this is just abusive nonsense, isn't it?
Now, how did I know that you'd come down on that side of it? All the romance has left you, hasn't it?
Well, it's not romantic, is it?
No, but I was being facetious.
Awful, you know. But for some people, it is a big awakening thing, and it seems like Emerald Ferrell is one of those people, because it's one of those things that she couldn't wait to make. So Margot Robbie, Jacob Elordi are your Heathcliff and Kathy.
The two that are doing that Chanel advert at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So the trailer is a very 2025. I mean, what have I got? I'll just list some of the stuff in the trailer. I've written
it
down.
If you would. Will this take a long time?
Well, we've got a whipped back, scars on a whipped back, heaving bosoms, bright red floor, squeezed in corsets, and a finger in a fish mouth. It is not subtle, right? It looks like it looks like she's had a lot of fun with it. I love Promising Young Woman, not so keen on Saltburn. I'm interested to see how this goes.
I really like Promising Young Woman. I think we said when we reviewed Saltburn, it was a bit of a cop-out, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it was just a bit schlocky.
Are you going to go and see this?
I am going to see Wuthering Heights because I'm not that precious about it. Do you know what I mean?
That's a good way to be. Yeah.
And I don't have a version of it that I think, you can't do that because this version's so special. Like, there's a 1992 version with Ralph Fiennes and Juliette Binoche, two of my favourite actors. And I watched it not that long ago and just went,
There's going to be a lot of that this week.
I think it's very difficult to say to a 2025 audience, look at the romance of this relationship, because it's not romantic. It's dysfunctional and weird. But I think if anyone can have fun with dysfunctional and weird in the Dales, it might be Emerald Ferrell. So I'm kind of looking forward to it. Like I say, because I'm not precious about it.
Yes.
If you want your different version, there's plenty. Do you know what
I
mean?
Oh, God, yeah.
So
yes.
Do something different.
Put
a finger in a fish mouth, see how you get on.
That's the Rick Stein version.
Yeah.
I saw this great trailer of a film called Killing Faith, which was supposed to come out this week, and I can't find it anywhere.
Because
it would seem to be going under a different name, for one thing. It's a Western with Guy Pearce and Bill Pullman. And it's just got this extraordinary moment at the beginning of the trailer, which took my attention. It's like a supernatural western sort of thing with Guy Pearce as a lone rider taking a woman and a child across the desert, maybe for her to be exorcised. And it's just that the child is standing before this horse and she touches the horse and the horse collapses and dies in front of her. And I think the woman says, I told you not to touch that horse. So it looks really interesting. How on earth we're going to see this, I've no idea. I'm not sure if it's out on streaming, what title it's going out under. I even read somewhere that it might be out on Blu-ray in 2 weeks. So have a look at the trailer. See if you feel there's some appeal for that to you. And it might be worth viewing. I'm just putting it out there.
Well, I've snuck in a trailer for Trailer Trash that is for a TV series. The Death of Bunny Munro, the adaptation on Sky of Nick Cave's 2009 novel. It stars Matt Smith, and the trailer came out this week. If you don't know the book, he's basically... Matt Smith will play a misogynistic middle-aged salesman who goes on a road trip with his son after his... I'm not sure if it's his wife or his ex-wife, I can't remember, but she's the mother of the son has committed suicide, and that's the opening of the film, and this is his son's view into his dad's weird and misogynistic and unpleasant life on the road. Matt Smith, I love Matt Smith. I think he plays quite a range of lovely, cute, foppy and absolutely abysmal and awful characters. So I'm interested to see how this goes.
Okay, that's going to be on...
It's on Sky from the 20th of November, yeah.
Okay.
So trailer's just come out this week.
You'll be taking Sky out for that then, will you?
Well, I've got it by default in another way. But it's also got Robert...
I mean, you've got a dodgy thing. Yeah.
It's got Robert Glenster and David Threlfall in it and Lindsay Duncan, and I love Lindsay Duncan too.
Right, so telly, I think that's all. That's all for that. Just having a step back to last week, where due to the ensuing chaos, we sort of did a tribute to Claudia Cardinale, and I would have loved to have played this particular piece of music, as I think it's a piece of music which is so closely associated with her, and I think also. It accompanies one of the great moments in cinema, and it's the theme from Once Upon a Time in the West, and it's the scene where Claudia Cardinale's character arrives in the town of Sweetwater, and it's all in one continuous shot. She gets off the train, she walks into the station, she's inside the station, and the camera pulls back a bit. She walks out the station on the other side, and the camera moves up. And it's a crane shot. It's not a drone. It's a crane shot. And you just see her walking into the distance. And this music accompanies it. And I might cry here when we're playing this, because I think this is... I think it's one of the great moments in cinema. So, Ennio Morricone's Once Upon a Time in the West. Oh, you're listening to The Film Show on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM and on digital. And that was Ennio Morricone's theme from Once Upon a Time in the West, paying proper tribute to Claudia Cardinale. Right, on to this week's feature bit, which has been induced by, I think, some maybe drugs on our part or something. all a bit weird, but we somehow pulled this together. We're looking at forgotten films. When does like a statute of limitations run out on a film that's been deemed so bad, so awful, that it cannot be seen, to when all of a sudden, well, actually, it's not as bad as what I thought it was.
and critics especially, like, disliking.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So we're having a quick canter through a few films here that are in various stages of re-evaluation, rehabilitation, and redemption. So I was going to start off with a film that's nearly 50 years old now, and notoriously deemed to be one of the worst films ever made, Exorcist II, The Heretic, the follow-up to William Friedkin's Oscar-winning, hugely successful horror movie, The Exorcist. The film was made 4 years after Friedkin's film. Friedkin and the writer William Blatty didn't want anything to do with it, but the studio really wanted a sequel. They'd made so much money out of The Exorcist. Eventually, British director John Borman was brought in on the film, and it had lots and lots of problems script-wise, but they put together something. Linda Blair was going to return as Regan. Max von Sydow was returning as Father Merrin, even though he passes away in the first film. And Richard Burton was brought in as a bit of a big-name star to bolster the rest of the cast. And the film went through enormous difficulties in production. John Borman almost died from a fever that he caught while they were making the film. The script was being rewritten almost on a daily basis. Richard Burton was going on a bender every day. So what came out of the end of it was incredibly different to the original Exorcist, and it wasn't what audiences were expecting. No head spinning, no projectile vomiting, no crucifix masturbation. Audiences were in uproar.
Disappointed.
With all this not being in there. And instead, Borman had made a film which was much more philosophical, metaphysical, and eschewed all of these sort of gory, special effects-inspired sequences. And its opening weekend, it did brilliant business. The week after, nobody was going to see it.
No word of mouth.
Word of mouth was zero. And since then, it has built up this awful reputation as being a really, really bad movie. Completely destroys the reputation of The Exorcist. So the film was initially released in a two-hour cut. That was then pulled, and it was cut down to an hour and 40 minutes. That didn't do any good. The film just sort of slipped into an embarrassed, oh, yeah, I don't really want to. People didn't really want to be associated with it. Mark Kermode, who thinks The Exorcist is the greatest film ever made, well, I'll leave that with you. hates it. You know, who cares?
Funny enough, my one's got a 2-star review from him as well.
Yeah, he knows nothing. Friedkin and Blatty badmouthed it. You know, and Friedkin has made some stinkers in his time as well. But now it would seem a 2-hour documentary has been made about the making of the film. That was premiered at Toronto, I think, this year, and that is going to be released soon. There is now a deluxe 2-disc Blu-ray package, which contains the 118-minute original premiere version, 103-minute international version, loads and loads of documentaries, commentaries, interviews, completely reevaluating the film. Now, what I'd say was, and I think we're going to say this about all the films we talk about here, they are, none of them are by no means perfect films.
But
they are flawed, but
how many films are perfect, and what would that be like?
As I always say,
it would be AI world, wouldn't it?
Beauty is in the flaws, not in the what you deem to be the perfections. And when you sit, I sat and watched this for the first time the other week. I'd never seen it before. I'd got the Blu-ray, and I was astonished at the artistry of the photography. There's all these in-camera effects with mirrors and glass and reflections, and it's absolutely astonishing. I think it is something that is worth reevaluating. And believe me, not all of it works still, but it doesn't deserve the terrible reputation that it ended up getting. So I think that one, let's say, well, I'll put that down as that's.
I think you said that's pardoned. On its journey, yeah. It's been pardoned. It's
pardoned, that one. The next one was one I think
that
maybe
one that we think is in parole.
Might be in parole.
Due for parole.
Richard Kelly's Southland Tales.
Now, this is Richard Kelly, Donnie Darko, Richard Kelly.
He's made Donnie Darko and was, you know, the massive success of Donnie Darko. He was allowed to do this. And it's,
but that was a nice little film that got big, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yeah. This was a big film.
That was pushed little.
But a nearly 3-hour cut of this, and it hadn't been finished, it didn't have the proper music, didn't have the special effects, was picked up to be shown in competition in Cannes in 2006. And after that one screening, it promptly disappeared for a year and a half. And so it came out in late 2007 in a quite severely reduced form.
But it stars someone we're going to be talking about a bit later, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Yeah. And one of the reasons why I picked this one, the stars were Dwayne Johnson, more of later, Sean William Scott, Sarah Michelle Gellar, Miranda Richardson is in there somewhere, Christophe Lambert. It's absolutely mad. It sprawls all over the place. It's just a mess, but it's a glorious mess. And one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about this one was, for one thing, we're going to be talking about Dwayne Johnson's Smashing Machine in a minute, but this is an art house movie that he did way, way before that. And his performance is really weird in this. He's really not Dwayne Johnson in it. He's playing a right-wing movie star called Boxer Santoro. And the film has so many mad sequences in it. There's Justin Timberlake lip-syncing to The Killers whilst being accompanied by a load of dancers in fetish nurses' uniforms. The film ends in a Zeppelin with Dwayne Johnson and Sarah Michelle Michelle Gellar dancing to Moby before the Zeppelin is exploded by a rocket. Everything in it is mad. But there are moments of absolute beauty in it. Yeah, loads of people don't like it, but it's one of those things, for me anyway, I've really got a soft spot for it. And I'm just sorry that Kelly hasn't made much since. He's made The Box since. And I think he's been in this sort of production limbo ever since, where people are unsure of giving him any money. So what have you got?
Well, what I've got is something that is still in prison. So I've got a mixed feelings about the film myself anyway, and the director. So I've gone for Damien Chazelle's fairly recent 2022 Babylon, which is, we said, it's an overwhelming mess of 3 hours and 5 minutes of cinema. But it is celebrating cinema, and it's specifically that era of silent cinema transitioning to talkies. I mean, it inserts Singing in the Rain quite a lot in key points of the film, and it's sort of the ending of the film is one of the characters identifying with Singing in the Rain, but it kind of inserts in its own story as if it imagines those scenes in Singing in the Rain happening. Very much loving Singing in the Rain. You've got characters in there that are, there are some real figures from Hollywood and there are some imagined composites of, so Margot Robbie sort of plays this Clara Bow type figure. Who meets Manny, who is a Latin American sort of dog's body fixer. He ends up getting, because he gives a lift of home to a film star, Brad Pitt, who is a big silent movie film star.
And he's a bit like John Gilbert, isn't he?
He's a bit like John Gilbert, but there's elements of Rudolph Valentino, and sort of his career trajectory is going to be, he's not going to make it to the talkies. He's not going to cut it. The film starts off a bit like, my issue with La La Land is a bit like this. It starts off with this great opening number, and I think, oh, I'm going to love this film, and then I don't love it, and I can't always tell you why. And Babylon is a brilliant first half of a film in just, there's some really key moments in there of, especially Margot Robbie. There's a scene where Margot Robbie is crying on cue, and she is just a natural in front of the camera. And you get that sense of it, and the, you get the sense of this Wild West chaos. But it is, a lot of the critics at the time when it came out gave it 2 to 3 star middling reviews. There were some defenders for it, but I can understand the criticism of it. And sometimes we want a film that we want, not what, what's been made. And we can be critical of that. And so film fans, especially cinema, you know, that love the story of cinema, want something in more in depth or more. And this is a bawdy comedy. I mean, it starts off with an elephant pooing over a character. There is a gratuitous sex scene with Margot Robbie at this sort of high society party where they're trying to reinvent her. And so she instead she gets really drunk and does a very impressive projectile vomit over people in a carpet. And it has a kind of a messy ending that there is a lot of... Oh, is it finished? No. Oh, there's more. Oh, right, there's more. Oh, we're going to 1952. Oh, and there's more.
I hate endings like that, and I just end it.
But I do feel like people that... There's a lot of defenders of the film online, of film lovers, that just really want to enjoy the film. And when they get older, and they're the film critics of the future, this might be one that's out.
And this will be one. It'll be on a dual Blu-ray with a director's cut, as both Southland Tales and Exorcist 2, the Heretic, both are. I hope they've just given you some ideas if you want to maybe explore some certain films that you might not have considered before. And if you don't enjoy them, well, we're not saying you're going to.
We're not saying you're going to.
But going back to Exorcist 2, The Heretic, it does feature an absolutely amazing Ennio Morricone soundtrack. One that's not very well known, probably because the film's been in Purda all this time. And this is Regan's theme.
Thank you.
You're listening to the film show on Sheffield Live. We've just had an argument about opera.
And William Shatner. Not often you hear those two subjects in the same
sentence.
That's
Ennio Morricone, just inspirational.
Yeah, that was I think a really beautiful track, that. Regan's theme from Exorcist 2, The Heretic. Okay, reviews. Am I going first?
Yeah.
Okay, I went and did this week's, well, what seems to be the big movie, The Smashing Machine, with Dwayne Johnson, again, and Emily Blunt, directed by Benny Safdie. And the Safdie brothers are doing a lot of interesting stuff over the recent years. They've got a ping pong one coming out. The other Safdie brother has done a ping pong film with Timothée Chalamet. Anyway, this is about Mark Kerr, who was one of the early exponents of this mixed martial arts, wrestling, fighting. And in the late 1990s, he is wrestling a lot in America and Japan, establishing this form of sport. He goes through... I have to say, this film didn't grip me that much. And it seems that I got a feeling it was going through the motions. He has trouble with promoters, management. He has trouble with pain-killing drugs. He is under pressure all the time to be winning. His domestic situation is very, very fraught. But I just had a sense I'd seen all this before. And maybe that's unfair. It's based on a true story. Mm. That horrible phrase we'll be trying out later again. But there was just something about it that I just didn't find... Nothing in it moved me that much. I don't know if you've seen the trailer where he talks to a young boy in a doctor's surgery.
Yes, I have.
And to me, that was the most tender and the most honest moment in the film. And the other thing about it was Emily Blunt as his girlfriend stroke wife. I found her far more interesting, and I wanted to know more about her, and I didn't really feel that I was getting that, her situation.
Did you feel like they were holding Emily back?
I just think it was, I don't know.
Or have they underwritten a woman's part?
What are you going to do with a film with The Rock in? You know, I mean, he is. You've got to say he throws himself into it. He's. I don't think he was urinating in empty bottles or anything like he was with that Christmas film.
God.
Like, and he really does go. But the other thing, he looks grotesque in it. He's really, really pumped up. But yeah, it's like it's like both their stories, but she doesn't get what she needs to get. And I think that would have made the thing more emotional, had more of an effect.
Right.
Whereas it ended and I just sat there and went, okay. What time is it? Oh, yeah.
Well.
So I'm just gonna give it a
Okay. The House of Dynamite. Out very limited release in cinemas this week. It's on Netflix either next week or I think the week after. New Catherine Bigelow film. And, oh, my gosh, when Catherine Bigelow is good, she's very, very good, isn't she?
She's one of the best directors working.
I mean, the premise of this, very briefly, a missile's been launched at North America. They cannot determine where it was launched from or who. We're on about a 20-minute countdown to it going off. And it's just the scramble of people in various jobs within authority in America to try and figure out what's going on, what's going to happen. And a lot of this happens like in rooms with screens on conference calls. And for that, to make this film out of that, it's quite an achievement. The way it's structured is you get your opening and then we repeat these 20 minutes because they've only got 20 minutes. So we repeat these 20 minutes three times with various levels of groups. So you've got the team that are a military team that are trying to launch something to stop it. You've got the people making the decisions in the White House, who are like the lowest level of the White House, who are the operations room.
Yeah.
Which Rebecca Ferguson is the sort of the leader of that shift. So British that I forget she's Swedish a lot of the time.
You do, didn't you?
Yeah. And then you have a third group, which are the more senior staff who don't really know, because the lower level staff know what their process is. They know their procedure. They've rehearsed it a lot of times. Whereas when you get as high as the president or the chief of defence, they're like, "What am I doing? I don't know what I'm doing now." And they've all got these books. The guidelines, and you end up with like the president has a naval officer with this basically a laminated instruction book that could be a recipe book.
Yeah.
Do I want to, and their decision really is, do we retaliate? If we retaliate, what happens? How many people die? If we don't retaliate, we're too weak. We need to retaliate, or do we? I don't know. And that's basically the president on a helicopter going, I don't know. How do I do this? I don't know. I'll phone my wife.
They did this about 60 years ago with films like Failsafe.
Yeah, there's lots of films that you can. But I think making this film now,
yeah,
and the situation America is in politically, like the guys in the authority jobs here, you kind of trust that they're decent people. Mm. It's not imagining a current cohort by any means.
And it shows there are these films, like last week's One Battle After, that are, they're resonating with what's happening. Southland Tales was like that. Mm. This was a film where whose time has come, you know.
But it does the usual thing of like imagining, understanding the human. There is a human behind all of these, but they're in this process. So they're a cog in this wheel. So much of this process, they've made this process with the laminated folders that, they all want to reach out and get their own phones and speak to their own family, but they still do the process. They still do the job. And it almost seems inevitable. The film does it in a very clever way of suggesting the inevitable, but not making everything explicit.
Yeah. Mm. Right, so as I say, that's in cinemas now. It will be on Netflix in 2 weeks, I believe.
Try not to have nightmares, but yeah.
Yes. Are you doing your next one, or do you want me to do...
You do your next one.
Okay, I caught The Lost Bus.
The
on
Lost
Apple.
Bus.
A strange title. It sounds like it's an Ealing comedy.
Yeah, Lost Our Bus.
What about our dinosaurs
is missing?
It's not.
Not like that, no.
It's about a massive wildfire in California, I think the Camp Fire, and it's based on a true story, about a bus driver who picked up 20-odd kids in a school bus and managed to navigate his way through an inferno of hell and get them all to safety. It stars Matthew McConaughey. It's directed by Paul Greengrass. It's pretty good. I mean, Greengrass is great with these sorts of things. Disasters.
I was going to say, he's a bit like your Bigelow in terms of can deliver every time, really.
And on the good side, technically it's amazing. And the way he rang, it's like two stories going on. There's like the big story of how the fire is engulfing this entire region. And then there's this more intimate story of McConaughey, this bus full of children, and how they are trying to get to safety within all this. And he handles it brilliantly, flicking between, you know, the macro and micro levels. It's well worth a watch. The only thing that did get on my nerves a bit was the amount of agony that was piled onto Matthew McConaughey's character. He was, you know, this bus driver, he was trying to get extra hours. He had bills to pay. His elderly mother was ill. His estranged son was living with them and he wasn't getting on with him. And his dog had cancer. And by the end of it, I was thinking, no, give this guy a break. And there was a lot of exposition to that, which then sort of seemed to be conveniently forgotten once everything was burning. But it'll carry you along for 2 hours.
Righto. I'm going to give a quick mention to a couple of films. First one is a new release, Urchin, debut film from the ridiculously young Harris Dickinson. He's only 29. He must have done this when he was 28. You might remember him from Triangle of Sadness. He played Carl, the model in that. Love him in that. He's directing Frank Delane as Mike, who is this... at the opening of the film, he seems like a charming but lost, homeless young man. He's begging on the streets. Someone takes pity on him and tries to buy him a sandwich, and he attacks him. So this violent attack is a catalyst for him going to prison and then trying to reform a bit. But it's a really difficult journey, and it's not necessarily one that he's going to be successful in. And the film has these moments of weird, almost fantasy, trying to get into this young man's mind. It's really well done in places. It's a very promising debut. Try and catch that if you can. And I just want to give a quick mention to Redux Redux, which was the closing film at Spirit of Independence Festival last weekend. It hasn't got a UK release as yet, but look out for it if you're interested in watching a film about a woman time travel to murder repeatedly the man that killed her daughter, and she's searching for a parallel universe in which her daughter is still alive. It is a really, really tightly directed film by Kevin and Matthew McManus, and it stars their sister Michaela McManus, and that I think that closeness obviously shows in the result they've got. It's a non-stop thriller, bit of a sci-fi, bit of a thriller, really, really well done.
Okay, well, we're going to have a quick rejig here, and we're going to do a quick race through films that are going to be out next week, and we'll just end with
I'm gonna do
track three. But anyway, things being released next week: Roofman,
Channing Tatum, isn't it, that?
And Kirsten Dunst. I might go and see it. It's Kirsten Dunst, okay. Tron Arse. Oh, I'm sorry. That seems to be a spelling mistake. Is that Tron Ars or Tron Ares? Or is it Lord Charles?
Do you know, I went to see Tron for my birthday, the original film.
How old were you then?
About two.
And a bit. why have they done a Tron?
I don't know, but Jeff Bridges is in it.
That's not always an excuse to make a film. And it's like, this is like some retirement thing he's got, isn't it? Oh, I'll make a Tron film every 30 years. Jared Leto is in it, who apparently is like box office poison at the moment. So, and the trailer looks so generic. I was falling asleep during the trailer. But, hey, if that's what you like, good luck to you.
Have you seen that The Light are doing a John Carpenter season?
Yes.
For October.
Yeah.
That's quite exciting. That starts with Escape from New York from the 10th of October.
Call me Snake. you can't beat a John Carpenter.
They've got Halloween, The Thing, They Live, and Big Trouble in Little China.
It's funny you should mention The Thing. It's like,
it's all come together. Hated, slated on release.
Our final. Are we done, or was there anything else you wanted to?
Oh, that's enough. For okay, this. That's enough for 1 week.
We're going to wrap up with a final piece of Ennio Morricone music. His theme, which he did in collaboration with Alan Howarth and John Carpenter for The Thing, which unbelievably now was hated and a huge box office failure when it first came out. Let alone now, it is probably one of the greatest horror films of all time, with some of the greatest special effects of all time. We're going to say goodbye, and you'll feel really cold by the time this piece of music has ended. How do you say at the end? Let's stick around. See what happens. Enjoy your films.
Oh, enjoy your films. Bye-bye.